Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on this Tuesday edition. Here's what we're going to talk about today. Some of the things, anyway. Everyone needs a good rest. We've got some good advice on how to do that. We've got a list of 50 things millennials have never heard of. We'll test Grant and Abraham, see if they know. For solace and solidarity in the Trump age, liberals are turning the TV back on, apparently. We've got details about that. And the dirty underbelly of the dairy industry. That and more coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. And we're online, kpcg.fm, thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live at 101.3 KPCG online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com. Happy Tuesday to you. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here. Grant came in and was you were bombastic.
That's a good word for it.
Very
gregarious, you said as well.
Gregarious and excited. And so I asked you, I said, what's what gives besides it just being Tuesday? And you're doing this new diet thing. You say you feel pretty good.
I feel really good. Yeah, it's no sugar, no dairy, and no bread. And also, I'm going to Outback Steakhouse when it's over, so I'm also excited about that part of it.
We are not sponsored by Outback Steakhouse. Not yet, anyway. Well, good. I'm glad you're feeling better. We've got some information about sleeping a little later on that kind of might tie into that somewhat, because that's a big thing. People need enough rest. So we've got some interesting tips on that. March Madness is starting out here, I guess, this week, right? Yeah, for the NCAA College Men's Basketball Tournament. Always an exciting time for people, I think. A lot of people like the games, and even those that don't kind of like the hoopla. Not every team makes it in. There's a lot of teams that sit on that bubble. They don't quite make it, and they get upset. Dan Mueller, I think his name is, he's the head coach of Illinois State, and he is not happy his team got left out. He had some strong words for the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee. His team went 27-6 and didn't get into the tournament. That's a pretty good record. They didn't get in, and this is where it gets interesting. They said their strength of schedule was not tough enough. They didn't play teams that were good enough to qualify. You know, we could, I guess, play grade school teams and hopefully go like 100-0. You're not going to make the tournament. But this isn't the case with this. These guys are pretty good. So the coach sent out a challenge to the entire nation. He sent a tweet out that read, ACC, Big 10, Big 12, SEC, Pac-12, Big East. It's me again, looking for home and home next year. Please call me for chance for quality road win. Because his point is, I don't make the schedule. He said, my schedule wasn't strong enough. I don't decide who I play. You decide. So he's trying to get these bigger schools to play him so they'll get into the tournament next year. I think he's got a good point.
And the bigger problem for him being at a smaller school is that the big schools normally cherry pick these smaller schools to whip up on, and the smaller schools don't really have a say in it. They just have to take the opportunity when it's there for them. Here he is actually reaching out, and yet probably none of these big schools will actually take him up on it because it's too risky. Obviously, he's really motivated to beat them, and he's not just going to show up to get some publicity.
I think years back, the tournament came through Oklahoma City, the first round or two, and I went down to that, and I think Illinois State was playing.
Southern Illinois, I thought it was.
Was it Southern Illinois?
Salukis?
Okay.
That's what I was thinking when you brought that up.
You're right. It was Southern Illinois. Yeah. So it wasn't Illinois State, but still, it's always great when some of those smaller schools get in because, you know, it's a chance of a lifetime for them to get some notoriety. And you get to go up against the big schools, and who knows? Maybe you knock them off. That's the fun, the first round, second round upsets, and that team that nobody expects, you know, going further than anyone would think. That's what's fun about the tournament, I think.
Look at Butler a few years ago going to the championship game back when they had Gordon Hayward, who now plays for the Utah Jazz. Mm-hmm. But that small school in Indianapolis almost knocked off Duke, so that was within a half-court shot being made of them winning the championship.
Yeah, and it almost went in.
It did.
It kind of rolled around. And
banked, rolled off the rim, and went out.
Yeah, so that's it's always fun when that comes around. I think a lot of it is because of the chance that a small school beats a big school, you know? And so it gives the sports guys something to talk about anyway. as if they needed something else, I guess, but they'll be talking about that. That's coming up, I think it starts, well, it starts earlier now. It starts Wednesday, doesn't it, with like the, they have like a, they play to get in. They've kind of built the little pre-tournament, right. And then Thursday, Friday, and so on.
I'm a little bit confused by that because there's four play-in games. Two of the games are for the two last 16 seeds. So those are the bottom seeds in the entire tournament. But then there's four teams playing for two number 11 seeds. Like, those are not even close to the bottom seed, and yet they have to play a game to even make it into the tournament. I was pretty confused by that. Why are they not playing for maybe two more 16 seeds or a couple of 15 seeds?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. But it's going to be interesting to watch if the experts say Duke is going to win it all, which means Duke won't win, of course. So who knows? Yeah, anybody could win. I don't have any big thoughts on it. I'd like to see UCLA do pretty well because I like watching Lonzo Ball. I went to University of Wisconsin. I'd like to see them do well, but I don't have my hopes up too high there.
Not this year?
No, I mean, if they could win a game or two, that'd be nice, but they're in a really tough bracket, as I understand it. If they win their first round matchup, then they got to play Villanova, which is the one seed. So.
That's what I picked, yeah.
Yeah, so Wisconsin's always an interesting team because you never know. They could go in and do great or just be destroyed. Like, you have no idea what's going to happen when they go in.
That's entertaining.
Yeah, it keeps you on the edge of your seat. But I don't have high hopes for my school. Actually, Marquette's in as well. That's from Wisconsin. Mm. So two Wisconsin schools in. Right. And Abraham, you have any thoughts? Do you even know what we're talking about?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. He's Canadian, folks.
No, I actually, I'm not a big basketball fan, so I don't follow it as closely. But it is, of all the games I've watched, March Madness have always been the best games. Any NBA, any other league, March Madness has always been the best.
Yeah. There's a certain purity to it, because and just the fact that you have one chance, and if you lose, you're done. And, yeah. And a lot of these guys, this is the end of their basketball playing days on a high level because they're not going pro, and they're seniors, you know. And so that's the excitement. You see these bigger schools with all these really talented freshmen against a team that's been together for 4 or 5 years, and they're all seniors, and none of them are as talented, but they play well together. It's a really interesting mix.
Yeah, and especially for someone who doesn't understand the game as thoroughly, I can just relate to a bunch of young guys giving it their all. And just playing their heart out. And to me, that's the exciting thing. I don't get as excited about the technical aspects because I don't understand them. But when you see a young guy, probably at the pinnacle of his basketball career, just giving it their all, nothing left on the floor, that's just the best, I think the best game you can ever watch. And on a lighter note, my wife told me on KJ103, that's another station they're doing.
Never heard of them. No, I'm just kidding.
That other station.
they're doing March Madness.
Oh, okay.
And she almost called and entered me in.
Oh,
but
wow.
I'm glad she did.
So, like, in the bracket.
You have to compete against other men,
I suppose,
for manliness,
so.
And then one moves on and one.
Yeah, because I would have been a 16th ranked seed, and that would have been humiliating.
That's very interesting. Here's a couple of headlines that were sent in from some of our listeners. This is an interesting one. We talked a little bit about shopping malls on and off and some of the economic problems they're having. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Shopping malls are tracking your every move, they say. You go into a shopping mall with a smartphone. They say while you're browsing in the stores, the shopping center owners are tracking your movements and spending habits to try to figure out how best to arrange stores and mall layouts to boost shopping activity. So they're tracking you. They know where you are. They know what you're looking at.
It's very smart, but it's also a bit creepy.
It feels a little like they're invading your privacy. I get little updates on my phone. My phone knows where I want to go. It knows I go to work. I guess it's figured it out. I never did anything. So I woke up this morning and I had an alert and it said it would take me 6 minutes to get to work. I live close, which is nice. And it said I should expect a 1 minute delay. There's literally nothing. I'm like, did a squirrel? How? Like, what happened that would be a 1 minute delay?
You have exactly one stop sign in between you and work. Must be some problems going on over there.
It was a very specific thing that my phone figured out. I don't know how it figured it out. I didn't track it to see if it was correct. But anyway, sometimes you're just like, how do you know? Like, how are you knowing this? But shopping malls are doing the same thing to try to figure out how to best arrange their stores. And we'll see if that helps their productivity. I don't know that it will, or their profits. Here's another headline sent in, also from the Wall Street Journal. Does recess need coaching? Got to have a recess coach out there. We used to make up our own games. Now some schools say they need to get people out there to kind of get the kids going, get them active. Hey, let's play a game. Not a bad idea.
Yeah, it's kind of a symptom of the age, though, isn't it? It's probably more likely for a lot of kids now to just sit around and, even though they're outside, just sit around and talk, which, you know, talking isn't a bad thing, but when that's your one chance all day to finally blow off some steam and run around so that you're not actually causing that trouble in class, you should probably just be running around.
Yeah, you know, this sounds like gym class to me. That's what it was back in the day. That's where you had the coach tell you, like, okay, we're playing kickball today. We would organize our own sports, you know, and it would ebb and flow. Like, we'd play baseball for a while, then we'd play, you know, whatever, football, whatever's going on. Odd games we'd make up. We'd just shove people on the ground. King of the hill, right? Wintertime, get on the hill. And, you know, in Canada, you know about that, Abraham. You get up on the mountain, the snowbank, and try to chuck people off of there.
Yeah. Well, a big thing we did actually was tobogganing. As soon as, especially when the kids are younger, as soon as recess starts, it takes you about half of recess to put on all your clothes, like winter clothes anyway. But you get out, grab your toboggan of choice, and then you try to go down the hill as much as you can before you have to go back in for classes.
Oh, wow. We weren't allowed to have paraphernalia like that. Did they have the metal runners on them?
Most of the kids, I think, had something called a crazy carpet. It's just like basically a sheet of plastic with two handholds in it. But yeah, they actually had this like a storage place where you could keep your stuff there.
Wow.
Like for the kids. So that was pretty nice.
Yeah, we didn't have, they wouldn't let us do that. unless we went on a special, like we would go to this camping place and stay there for like a day or two in grade school, and all the grade schools could use it. It was really nice. And sledding in the winter was a lot of fun. And, we were going down on the trail, and, my friend was in front of me, and we were coming up to a tree. And in a selfless act of bravery, he put his leg out to stop us, and he broke his leg.
Oh.
But he protected me.
Oh.
So it wasn't a horrible break. It was just, you know, it was bad enough, but not like, you know, it wasn't like a compound fracture or anything.
Oh, yeah.
But so anyway, when I think of sledding, I always remember that, like heading towards that tree, and he just stuck his leg out. Boom, there you go.
There was my dad always tells us a story, and you probably, if you ever meet him, he'll probably tell you this story as well. When he was a young boy growing up in Canada and Saskatchewan, they went sledding, and they grew up around a lake, so there are lots of hills around there. And that when they were going down, they went down the hill before they were going down the hill, and then the further they went down, they noticed there was something up ahead of them. And this huge, vast, open, wide hill, there was this washing machine on the hillside just right in front of them. They ran into it.
Wow. That's it was a clean crash, though.
Yes.
Yeah. The washing machine. Yeah, it's strange. You wouldn't expect to see that there. And it does happen where you're sledding. You can't really, you can bail out sometimes of the sled, but you can't turn it.
Yeah.
And so that's actually a lot of fun. It makes me want to do it again. or inner tubing, if you've ever done that, and going down a hill. That's a lot. Have you ever done that, Grant?
I've done inner tubing in the water, which is actually quite fantastic as well. And then when you fly off, the water is almost like rock hard, so you hit pretty hard as well.
You can have fun with inner tubes on a lot of surfaces, including we would always try, because you'd go to places where you'd pay to inner tube, and they had like the tow rope to pull you back up and stuff. But you always try to pile enough people on to get enough weight to jump into the parking lot. That was always, we thought that was a good idea. Thinking back on it, I'm thinking we probably shouldn't have, you know, you wouldn't want to be in the parking lot sliding on an inner tube, you know, because of moving vehicles.
Yeah. Oh,
yes. But at the time, we you get it spinning in a circle, and then somebody jumps on at the very end, and you're trying to push them off. It was a lot of fun. This is an interesting one related to the benefits of sleep and some things that don't help with sleep. This is from Fox News. Experts debunk the biggest myths about sleep. The number one myth, they say, is that taking sleeping tablets ensures a good night's sleep. You always see the commercial where they take a pill and a green butterfly flies in and then they fall asleep. That's what happens, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's pretty much what occurs. You may see the butterfly, I don't know, but you will not have a better night's sleep. They say studies have shown that sleeping tablets increase total sleep time an average of only 25 minutes. That's surprising. You would think it would be a couple of hours, but no, only 25 minutes on average.
Yeah, well, I think, too, talking to people who have taken them in the past, it's almost like it's not really sleep. Like, you fall asleep, like, your body's asleep, but your mind didn't fall asleep naturally, so it just doesn't feel as restful or is unless you get used to it, I suppose, but it's just a little different type of experience.
Yeah, that's interesting. Never done that, and that's just not something I think much about. Number two, myth as far as sleeping goes, a nightcap will help me drift off. They don't mean a hat you wear to bed. They're talking about a drink.
Oh, I see.
Although alcohol will make you sleep more quickly, it also has significant negative effect on sleep quality and quantity. In the first half of the night, it brings on a deeper sleep, but it suppresses the REM dream sleep. And once the alcohol is worn off, there is a rebound effect, and then you have more episodes of wakefulness and lighter sleep. So it might help you relax and fall asleep quicker, but then you're going to wake up typically and not sleep as deeply. So I have heard that before, that that is a myth. The third myth about sleeping, they say you can make up for lost sleep on the weekend. Can't always do it. We can sure try, though. They say 2/3 of the population go to bed later and sleep in at the weekends, but they may be experiencing social jet lag. A change in pattern disrupts the natural rise and fall in the body temperature, which in turn delays onset of sleep. So what happens is you don't sleep good on Sunday night, and you go back to work Monday all messed up because you've changed the pattern.
That's a pretty common experience for a lot of people. I've definitely experienced that as well, where you don't necessarily have a whole lot of things going on over the weekend, but for some reason you still feel tired when you come back on Monday, and that's probably why.
Yeah, exactly. You get more sleep, but then a lot of times you stay up a little later, mm-hmm. and it kind of throws things off. You guys are a little bit younger than me, and you're both millennials, right?
Really? I thought you were same age.
Yeah, no. No, you didn't, and no, I'm
yeah,
not.
Yeah, no.
50, this is a list of 50 things. We won't do all of them, but I'll quiz you on a couple. 50 things millennials have never heard of. Now, this is pretty general, right? It depends on who you are. Depends on how you know who you hung out with and whatnot. But these are some things that are kind of more from the 1980s, early 90s, that they say millennials have never heard of. Some of them are kind of pop cultures. Some are political figures. Some are just technology things. We'll have a few here and see what you think. Have you heard of Too Legit to Quit?
Oh, yeah. I still use that today.
It's a song, right?
Yeah.
You know who sang it?
No.
MC Hammer.
Didn't know that.
You know who that is?
Yes. Yeah.
He had the pants.
The parachute pants.
The hammer pants.
Yeah.
And it has a whole dance to it, too. It's something that's like this and this, and he does this thing. Okay. I think you guys will know these ones because you're more political buffs, I guess, in some ways. Ross Perot?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That. I could see a lot of people not knowing who that is, but he was quite a wealthy businessman. Man, and he ran for political office, never really got all that close, but he caused a little bit of a sensation, and he was always famous for saying, can I finish? Like, he'd be talking to interrupt him, and he'd always say that. He was, I don't know if he was from Texas, I think he was, and he had a real, you know, accent, so they'd always kind of make a little fun of him on some of the shows. You'll know this one, Mikhail Gorbachev.
Yes.
Sure, Russian leader there. The process of getting film developed.
Yes, I think so.
Oh, you mean from a camera?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I would think most people would have heard of that, but apparently they say some people have not. Have you ever heard of the TV show Dinosaurs?
No.
I don't think so.
It's kind of an animated thing. Yeah. That was a show. It was popular for a while back in the day. There was a little baby dinosaur. His name was Baby Sinclair, and he had a catchphrase that said, "I'm the baby, gotta love me."
Is that why the gas station Sinclair has a dinosaur on it?
Oh.
That's a good question. That's a good question. I don't know. But it's funny because I remembered that, but I haven't thought about it in years until I saw the list. I'm like, oh, right, that show. Like, it was funny. It was funny for a while. I'm sure you've heard of this, but apparently some millennials have an answering machines.
Yes.
Yep.
Sure. You know, at your house, come home and it's blinking. You got to play the message. The program Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Yes.
No.
You've never heard of that one?
Well, I mean, I might have heard that phrase before, but I didn't know it was a show.
Right. Yeah, it was the guy's name was Leach, I think. I can't remember what his first name was, Robin Leach or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've seen a little bit of some episodes.
They go around and they'd show Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. You know, and there's been spinoffs since then.
Oh, they haven't stopped at my house yet.
No. The Middle Class and Obscure. That wasn't a popular show from... Have you heard of the character Nick from the show Family Ties?
No.
I don't think so.
Have you heard of the show Family Ties?
Vaguely.
Michael J. Fox?
No.
Heard the name. I don't really know him either.
Yeah. It's kind of an obscure thing they put on the list because I'm like, well, yeah, they probably wouldn't remember a lot of characters. But he was a sort of, because the family was sort of this kind of highly educated. I think the dad in the show worked at like NPR or something. And And so the daughter starts dating this guy that's a little rough around the edges. You know, he's an artist. He wears a leather jacket. Didn't graduate high school. He says, like, hey, oh, stuff like that. So it was an interesting thing. My favorite memory of him actually on the show is he comes into the living room, and he has a big carton of milk, which we're going to talk about milk later, so this ties in. And he's drinking out of it, and he's trying to be, like, gracious, but he doesn't know what to do. So he looks around. He's like, hey, this milk's for everybody. And they're like, that's fine.
We don't want to drink out of the same thing as you.
Right, yeah.
Is that where Michael J. Fox got his start?
It could be. Definitely one of the places. And then he was in movies and stuff, yeah. Okay. So he was the teenage son. He really loved President Reagan. He was like a Republican in this very liberal family. He'd always wear like a suit to high school. It was sort of an odd... But it's a really, actually, it has some funny moments on there, and they still run that on, like, the older, you know, like, the rerun networks. Have you heard of the Choose Your Adventure books?
Yes. No.
Yep. That's where you read it, and they give you a decision. You know, if you want to go into the cave, turn to page 32. If you don't want to go into the cave, turn to page 90.
Oh, I've done those before.
Okay.
I didn't know what they're called.
Right. Choose your own adventure. Laserdiscs.
Laserdisc. I don't think so.
No.
These were, they say, about four times bigger than the DVDs as far as the physical size. A lot more expensive than VHS tapes, and they had to be turned over like vinyl records. So it was one of those technologies. They were coming away from the cassette, VHS, what do we do? And there was a few things that came up. Laserdiscs were one of them. Kind of, I remember like, ooh, laserdisc players, and then it just died out. And CDs and DVDs ruled the day. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, probably for a good thing, though, for a lot of reasons.
Have you heard of the L.A. Gear shoes?
No.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it was a popular brand back in the, I guess, late 80s. Karl Malone of the Utah Jazz had an endorsement with them for a while. The NBA outlawed them because they'd light up.
Oh.
That was the thing they did. Is when every time you stepped down, they'd, like, blink.
Right.
Now, kids' shoes do it, but back then that was the thing. And the NBA is like, you can't wear those. That was kind of the end, of LA Gear. Floppy disks for a computer. Have you heard of those?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
Used to play video games off of those.
Yeah.
Plunk them into computer.
Yeah, those are a little more well-known. The dial-up modem.
Yes.
The sound that it makes when you try to get on the internet.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like it's physically, like, moving pieces around. And yeah.
Yeah.
And you have to wait.
And when, especially when your friend's parents is trying to call their lawyer or something very urgently, but you're on the computer in the other room.
Right. And finally, have you heard of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Yes.
Mm.
Geography game?
No.
Yeah. I watched an episode of that like a month and a half ago.
Yeah. And when you first start out as a detective, you're the lowest rank. You're a gumshoe.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not really sure why you're a gumshoe. Like, is there gum on your shoe or you have gum-soled shoes? Like, I don't know what the... But we played it in grade school, I remember, and you'd get close, and then, like, Carmen Sandiego would, like, run by the screen. They'd be like, oh, you almost got him. Her. I don't really know what it was we were chasing, but it was to teach you about geography.
Too elusive. Couldn't even tell.
Couldn't tell. Didn't know. Even to this day, I don't know. So those are a few things that they say millennials have never heard of. Depends who you ask, but, yeah, I could see that happening. Of course, this one's happening. This is something I think the three of us should get involved in if we pooled our money. An entire southern Oregon town could be yours for $3.85 million. You can buy a whole town in Oregon if you'd like to. It's on sale right now, for sale. 3.85, so if we just kicked in, about a mil. the official listing for Tiller notes some of the key features of the town that would be included in the sale. You can get 28 lots that you can tax, apparently, 250 acres, multiple domestic and agricultural community water rights, nearly a mile of waterfront along the South Umpqua River, I probably got that wrong, and Elk River, including launch access for boats, approximately 2 million board feet of merchantable timber, and the Tiller store, the general store that's not currently operating but includes a deli, a commercial kitchen, a gas pump, and an apartment right there on the water. Nice little town, kind of in the middle of a forest, sort of out in the middle of nowhere. It's for sale, $3.85 million, a whole town.
Wow. Makes me regret not saving more of my money when I was a teen.
You could be king.
Could retire there, live with just like five people in that whole town.
They showed pictures of the general store, and there's still a fair bit of candy in there. stuff that's not going to go bad, you know, from whenever they abandoned. But that's the question. You're like, now, why is this town abandoned?
Yeah, some water poisoned or something? Are they not telling everything?
What happened in Tiller that we don't know about? But sometimes you see that happened in, I think it was North or South Dakota. They try to sell a town. They just sell the town. So wow. It looks beautiful right on the river there. So I think they actually say there's a lot of interest from China wanting to buy it.
Oh, yes.
And the other thing is, besides China, people want to buy it for hemp farming.
Oh, right. Come on.
So that's what they're saying. Anyway, Tiller, if you're interested. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. The Key of David program's coming up in a bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com. One of the top stories today, South Africa mulls forced land redistribution by Andrew Miller. So that's an interesting read there. Grant, you've got an article for us here from the New York Times. For solace and solidarity in the Trump age, liberals are going back to an old-timey technology, television. They're turning the TVs back on, I guess.
Yeah, this is a trend that stuck out to me just because we all thought that maybe the mainstream media was going to take a big hit after the election and how they ended up being wrong about who was going to win the presidency. But now what it looks like is certain people are looking to their favorite shows on MSNBC or CNN or ABC for some comfort. And then this also has a benefit for a station like Fox News, where a little bit more conservatives would tune in to try and hear what they want to hear. So basically people are choosing what they want to hear, and they're actually listening. They're keeping up with the news more than they would have before.
They're like, we see this trend even in the late night TV ratings, because there's always that battle. I guess it's a three-way battle to some extent between Jimmy Kimmel, Colbert, and then Jimmy Fallon. Right. I think it's more between Fallon and Colbert. But Colbert's ratings have been, he's been winning. And he's very political and pretty acidic in a lot of ways. But I think because people are a lot more into the politics right now, especially maybe the crowd that would watch his show, his ratings are going sky high. And so on the other side of it, you have Jimmy Fallon, who's more of kind of the fun and games and playing games and celebrities. And so he's got to try to get more political now, too. So it's a ratings war. And like this article highlights, people seem to be primarily interested in political talk.
Right. And you can tell Jimmy Fallon's feeling the pressure a little bit, because he had been beating Stephen Colbert ever since Colbert got his own show not too long ago. And he recently just got passed in the ratings. So whenever he was hosting one of these award shows, he did actually make a few jokes about the president, which is an extreme rarity for someone like him. It just goes to show you that he knows what made Stephen Colbert more popular than him.
Yeah, so it is interesting. At the end of the day, it is about the ratings. They want to get the eyeballs there so they can obviously make money on their commercials and so forth. And so it's interesting. So I think I saw a little bit of this headline the other day, and some of the shows like MSNBC, Rachel Maddow.
She's highest in 9 years.
Yeah, her ratings are sky high because people are rallying kind of in this anti, I guess, President Trump sort of camp. And they're going to these people that are, I guess, sort of the leaders in a way, or the people they listen to as far as watching television and such.
Right. And it also looks like the comic shows are kind of following the same pattern. They're all sort of galvanized by this, you know, basically unexpected election result. Bill Maher's program has gone up by 50% of viewers. And The Daily Show, which is now under Trevor Noah since 2015, has had its highest ratings ever since he took over. So a lot of these shows are really gaining in popularity. And then MSNBC, which by most people is considered more left-leaning than even CNN, has actually started beating CNN pretty consistently in primetime, I think like 6 out of the last 7 months. And even Rachel Maddow beat out Tucker Carlson recently, which is pretty impressive because I think Carlson has the best ratings on Fox News.
Yeah, that's very interesting to see those trends. It does kind of remind me of towards the end of President Bush's administration. It was kind of the same sort of thing. Who was doing The Daily Show back then? It was Stewart, right?
Jon Stewart.
Right. He was very, there was even a study showing that most young people got their quote unquote news from The Daily Show, which is it's a comedy show, you know? And so, a lot of the people in the media, they were all kind of together in the same thing. They were against the current administration at the time, which was President Bush. And then the Obama years is a little different because they kind of liked him. So I don't know. It's not the same probably desire to tune in because what are you going to say? You know, great job, keep it up. What? There's not the same animosity at that point, but now it's swinging back with the Trump administration.
And it does seem like grief and anger draws more viewership when, you know, the audience is upset with what's going on in the world. They're more likely to tune into the news and hear, you know, a critique of the administration that they don't really like that much. And the reason they're going to TV instead of these other mediums, I thought this was really interesting, is there's like a sense of community there because you know that maybe about a million other people are watching the show at the same time as you, probably feeling the same things you are. And so it's like you're all one family feeling the same emotions about the same things.
Yeah, really. And for a lot of those shows, as much as they, you know, probably don't like some of the things in the current administration, they really have to credit the administration with their ratings jump because it gives them, I mean, it's not like they have to go in every day and say, what are we going to talk about today? They know what they're going to talk about, something related to what's going on there in Washington. And they know that their audience, for the most part, is already in agreement with kind of their take on it. So it's just a matter of finding stuff and then picking at it. And it's much easier to sit there and just pick at something as opposed to, I don't know what they would talk about normally. That's kind of what those shows are, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, as opposed to like going and finding some sort of in-depth journalism or putting effort into some sort of a story that would be enlightening, just taking shots at whatever was said from Washington that day. So it's like a handmade show every day for them.
Yeah, it's easier to take shots than it is to get in depth with something. And it's also what the viewers probably would prefer. It's more humorous. You don't have to think as much about what you're watching. You just can relax and have a good laugh about it. Saturday Night Live is soaring in popularity as well. They have had a lot of, obviously, anti-president skits. They have one about Melania Trump recently, like a new perfume that she had called Complicit. Like that's what it was called, how she was complicit in supposedly her father's crimes. So they've been striking out, and I know a lot of supporters of Mr. Trump are also watching it just to get angry about whatever they're doing there. So either way, people are watching because they're having some sort of emotional response to the show.
Well, and it's right in the wheelhouse for those shows, right? Because your comedy, your political comedy sketch shows, or some of your I guess more liberal news programs, they're anti-establishment. That's what they're founded on, and it's probably been strange the last 8 years because the government at the time wasn't really the establishment anymore that they were fighting against, but now it is again. And so that's right, what they kind of are comfortable doing is fighting the power, so to speak, and that's what they're doing.
Right. The Democratic Party really is embracing being kind of like the heel or the opposition now. I've seen some headlines about that too. That's sort of where they're a bit more comfortable, that they're not so much used to being the mainstream opinion, because until recently they never were. And so now this is kind of their role. This is kind of them striking back at their opposition.
Yeah, it's always easier to go on the offensive than be on the defensive. And probably during the Obama administration, they spent some of their time on the defensive, defending what was happening. And now they can just sit there and, you know, wait for anything that they don't like and say, well, look at that. And sometimes it's probably right about it, But it is interesting that they are they lost as far as their having their candidate get in, but they won in terms of ratings and revenue.
Right, and that's sort of a trade off that some of these show hosts are grappling with. Like, am I happy that I'm, you know, having these great ratings and probably making a little bit more money off my show, or am I upset that President Trump is in office? It seems like most of them would still rather make a little bit less money and not have Mr. Trump there.
Well, sometimes, sadly, it's some people, I guess, are a little more comfortable being negative about something than being positive, I guess. And so if you can look at a target every day and kind of be, you know, negative about it, and sometimes it's a little more comfortable, I think, for some of those hosts. It's more in their wheelhouse of what they're doing, and it's paying them richly, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And it also goes right along with kind of the changing concept of what journalism is. It used to be thought that journalism was a balanced medium. Now a lot of people are mistaking these commentators for journalists and saying, well, they are doing their job because they're being accurate. well, they're being accurate compared to what their audience already believes. It's not always accurate. It's funny, but it's not always the exact truth.
Yeah, it's sort of become like the I gotcha whistleblower, point the finger, we caught you, you know, with what you were doing type of thing. So it's interesting. It's every time they talk about, you know, like TV going away as a medium, then here it comes. You know, people do turn back to it, whether they're consuming it on TV or watching it online, whatever. They're still getting the content, and people are getting paid. So I guess good for them. I don't know. Depends how you feel about it. But that's interesting write-ups from the New York Times. Grant, thanks for stopping and bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm with a live link at thetrumpet.com. And appreciate you being with us here on this Tuesday. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau. Abraham, you've got a really interesting article here. This is a debate that goes kind of back and forth. I've heard a little bit about over the years. It's the dirty underbelly of the dairy industry. There is a lot of regulation in a lot of industries, dairy industry in particular, and there's always talk about raw milk versus pasteurized, and this is a write-up that talks about some of what's happening in the dairy industry.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting article to look at what's going on right now, and can maybe make us think of the debate on whether we should drink pasteurized milk or raw milk. And so it's even recently there's been a lot of debate of people I talk to what you should drink and what you should be looking for, because it can impact your health pretty significantly. And this article is by Dr. McCullough. He's a pretty well-known health advocate. He speaks very strongly against pasteurized and processed foods. But in this particular article, he does outline some of the dangers by drinking pasteurized milk. So the milk you would buy at the grocery store. And so with raw milk, that's mainly sold by local dairies, local farmers. It's not sold at a local convenience store. And so the main points in this article that he covers are the dairy cows. The source of the milk is where most of the problems occur, and that is with something called concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFO, and that refers to cows who are put on GMOs, or so corn. They eat corn, not grain, and they eat different things, even gummy worms and Skittles, like we saw that
right
other story a little while ago. Or they, and they're also put on antibiotics. So those types of treatment to the animals. And he just makes the point that not only is pasteurizing wrong. So when you pasteurize milk, you boil it and you kill all the healthy bacteria inside of it. So it's basically sterile. And while that does eliminate some bad bacteria, it also kills all the good ones that your body needs to be healthy. And also it removes the minerals and all the other good things in the milk that come from the cow naturally. But even outside of pasteurization, if a cow is being fed using CAFOs, it's been proven by new research that can cause a lot of diseases in humans. And a big reason for that is that there are lots of unsanitary practices or different, these huge organizations like Bluebell, all these big companies that make yogurt and ice cream that use pasteurized milk. They've actually had lots of problems with listeria outbreak, different diseases in the milk, because just the milk has no bacteria fighting capability anymore once you pasteurize it.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's always very interesting. Years ago, Herbert Armstrong wrote a lot about health and foodless foods, and you know, saying that in the West here, really, we were having sort of a famine, but not a famine in terms of not food to eat, but just that wasn't valuable food. And that's been proven true time and time again, and you see that in write-ups like this and in new research like this. And, you know, because if you're not paying a lot of attention, you think, well, I'll just go get milk. You know, milk's milk, right? But it's not. It's different. And depending on the processes they put it through. And I think from what I've read about it, I mean, the excuse or the reasoning from the dairy industry is that, well, if it's raw milk,
there's a chance you could pick something up and it would cause a problem. That's why we run it through all these processes. But I think the numbers are extremely low of somebody actually catching something from raw milk, especially if it's done properly. But then again, you look at the other side, like you say, Listeria and some of these other outbreaks that are caused. And then beyond that, look at the long-term detriment caused to the consumer by either not getting it's a two-edged sword, right? You don't get the nutrients you should, and then you also ingest the stuff that's bad that's been added. And so maybe you don't drop over that day, but what if you're drinking this stuff for 20 years? What happens? Well, I don't know about exactly what would happen with something like milk exactly, but just when you look at the diets in general, well, look at the diseases we have today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rampant. Like, you almost expect to get, you know, check off the list, whatever the disease is, at some point. It's almost accepted as natural. Like, well, you just get that. Well, why do you get that, though? It's because you ate it. We right. all ate it, right? That's why.
Yeah, I remember Herbert Armstrong said you are what you eat. So if we ingest toxins, we'll be much easier to catch diseases. And with these, I have some statistics on what you just mentioned here. With CAFO cows, with just the cow itself, when they eat corn instead of grass, a cow's life expectancy is cut in half by 50%. So even the cows die faster.
You know what's so amazing about that? There are a lot of animal rights activists that get upset about treatment of animals and things, and sometimes they probably have a pretty good point. And maybe they do protest that. I don't know. But you don't hear a lot about protesting what's even happening to these animals in terms of just their own quality of life, if you want to call it that. But their quality of life gets a lot worse, and then when it's passed on to the consumer, that problem is passed on too. And maybe there are some protests about that. You hear it occasionally, but not as much as you probably should.
Yeah, and even with this, cows are kept in very unsanitary conditions, too close together, where they're just in a lot of muck and mire all the time. And so farmers inject them with a lot of antibodies to keep them healthy so they don't get sick in that environment. But what happens is the viruses become resistant to the antibodies, to the medicine they give them. And so the milk has those viruses in them that are resistant to modern medicine, and then we drink it. And so with those unsanitary conditions, we're actually creating super viruses that kill lots of people every year.
Right, because there are plenty of people that don't like the idea of taking antibiotics, but we eat them.
Yeah.
They're in the meat, they're in the milk, they're in a lot of things. And so, you know, whether you're talking about milk or you're just talking about any other type of food or even water coming out of like a city water system, sometimes you see those reports and they're kind of scary.
Yeah.
Like, here's what you're drinking, and there's a certain percentage of it that's prescription medication because people washed it down the sink. And you hate to look too much at that, but that is the reality of just our diets today.
Yeah, and for diseases related to drinking raw milk, in Britain since 2002, only two people have died from anything related to that. In the United States, it's been around 21, so slightly more. But when you compare that to all the other diseases caught, it's insignificant. And another problem with the dairy industry is not just pasteurization and these cows, it's also pesticides. Because in a lot of, he uses, in this article, he uses data from Vermont. But on a lot of farms, pesticides have doubled in the last 10 years, the amount they use per acre. And so one toxin in the pesticides and the herbicides is called atrazine. And this atrazine, if ingested by the human, so when the cow eats the food, it goes in the cow system, then goes into the milk, and then we drink it. And the atrazine can have these three effects on a human. It can have estrogen overproduction, which can contribute to the feminizing of males, reproductive problems, and estrogen-sensitive cancers like breast cancer. Second thing, it can have ovarian cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, hairy cell leukemia, and thyroid cancer. And the third one is birth defects, including abdominal defects such as gastroschisis, in which the baby's intestines stick outside of the baby's body. And all these things are documented, that if when humans ingest that kind of toxin from the herbicide or pesticide, it can have those effects. And so the main point this doctor is bringing out is that this is a widespread problem in a huge dairy industry. So any, like Walmart, any place where we buy pasteurized milk, this can be some of the effects that not only us, but our children will have when they grow up by us drinking it and them drinking it. And that raw milk is a good alternative if you can find it. But we just need to think about this. And then also just realize how polluted our food culture is, our food production is. Even when they have certain standards, they allow these things to slide because of the money involved.
Yeah, it's all about the money at the end of the day. A couple of interesting notes about that. The one disease you mentioned with the intestines on the outside. Years ago when my son was born and we were at the hospital here locally, there was a child there born same time, roughly with that condition. And it's not, obviously not a good thing.
Yeah.
And so I've seen the effect of that. And then also just because I grew up in Wisconsin, dairy capital, right? Supposed to be, apparently. Yeah. Well, I used to have a lot of family farms, but they get squeezed out because bigger dairies came in and took over. So what happens there is you've got a family-run farm. I don't know what they'd have. It depends. 30 cows, 35 cows. You know, I'm not sure if that's enough or too many. I don't know where that line is. But something that a family could manage. And those start to disappear. And then what you have is they put in these super dairies where they just hire people to come in and they milk those cows 24 hours a day. Now, yeah. It's different ones, but they're just rotating them through like a machine shop. And then, of course, pasteurization, all that's happening. So when you saw those family farms be squeezed out and the bigger money-making ones come in that could make more money and it make it more of an industrialized process, well, what did you lose? Well, we lost the health benefits of a lot of the food, the milk, and so forth. There's a lot of documentaries about that. They're pretty eye-opening. And granted, now, you don't know if it's all exactly right or if there's like a particular agenda somebody has, but I think a lot of it is pretty accurate as far as the modification of seeds, destruction of milk, destruction of the farms, and we're paying the price for it. Everybody else is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it becomes a matter of national security as well. If the health of the people falter, so will the nation. And so, and that's true with any industry, not just milk, and I mean, there is a balance. Not everyone can have raw milk. It's just not available. And then not all super dairies they have bad practices. I'm sure some are honest and they try their best. But yeah, so basically it's the push, to make more money, to keep production schedules, to keep up with demand, really forces these unfortunate practices to go on. And even the federal government, some of their agencies with food management, they've been targeting raw milk farmers and actually coming, instead of a food inspection where you just come up with a CDC official, they actually come with the sheriff and with the police. And it's a very forceful, very intimidating type of scenario with a lot of dairy farmers across the United States, small dairy farmers. So it's obviously, there's a pattern of intimidation, not in everywhere, but in certain places, to get rid of them and to allow the big dairy farmers to come in.
Yeah, and it's the system is so flipped on its head now that in some places it is illegal, I think, to do raw milk.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly, but I've heard that. And then too, a lot of people are starting to wake up to all this and be like, well, you know what, I don't want to eat that, I want to eat real food. And then they charge you a lot for it. And then even there, you don't always know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at probably the most popular, some of the most popular stores is the health food stores. And they have some good stuff, I think, or at least they try to have it a little better. But because the industry is so flipped around, some people, you know, can't afford it. You just can't. They buy what they can afford, and what they can afford is not the good stuff. They're keeping some of the prices lower, but you're not getting anything of value in that food.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a huge money-making machine, unfortunately. And just to end off, here are some good things that high-quality raw milk can do for you. Just end off on a positive note, I suppose. And even raw milk can help asthma. It can help prevent asthma from happening. As healthy bacteria, they're good for your intestinal tract. Has 60 digestive enzymes to help your antibodies to fight disease. It has conjugated linoleic acid. I'm not sure what it does, but it's good. beneficial raw fats, amino acids, and proteins in high bioavailable form, and vitamins A, B, C, D, E, and K. So, and even good fat actually helps prevent cancer if you have good fat in your body.
Right.
And milk is part of that. It's a good natural fat that actually helps prevent cancer cells from forming.
You know, I've had both over the years, I guess. And there's just the reality too that the raw stuff actually tastes pretty good usually.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on the farmer, how they do it, I guess. But even as a kid, the stuff that they would give us at school, it was terrible. Like,
yeah.
If it was chocolate, we'd drink it. But the white stuff, ugh, it just tasted terrible because it was so chemicalized. And it is interesting, too, because there's a lot of people that have food sensitivities, you know, lactose intolerant and such. And I think a lot of that, you know, comes from the fact that we're not actually eating the stuff that would naturally occur.
Yeah.
You know, what are we exactly having problems with? I don't know. Everyone has a different situation with that, and it's hard to know. But you know, that is a thing that's pretty common. People say, well, I can't eat this or I can't eat that. Well, it might be true, but, you know, exactly what are we eating? Is it milk like we think it is, or is it the chemical in it? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think a lot of food allergies, I mean, there's still debate on this, but even gluten, which is mainly bread products, milk allergies, all these things. Some people believe that they're actually just an allergy to the chemicals they put in it, not the actual food itself.
Yeah.
And I mean, even growing up, I used to be lactose intolerant. I had to drink goat's milk, which was unpasteurized. And I'm not lactose intolerant anymore. I grew out of it, I suppose. But usually if you drink the raw stuff, sometimes you're still allergic to it, but sometimes you're not. And same thing with cheese. A lot of that's made from pasteurized milk. But with gluten, I think that's probably the mainstream thing we've seen in health with being gluten-free. But the amount of things they put in bread is absolutely disgusting. Sugar, even in the 80s, they used to put rat poison in bread in America. All these different toxins. No wonder we get an aversion to gluten. Gluten's not bad. Your body needs it. But it's what's around the gluten, I think, is what destroys our ability to ingest in our bodies.
Yeah, really fascinating. Health is a very, very fascinating topic. There's some good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about that you can look into. Some just basic principles about it. Of course, everybody's probably a little bit different, but yeah, you can only ingest chemicals for so long before there is going to be a problem of some kind. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up here in a little bit on KPCG. And stop and check out thetrumpet.com feature story today, South Africa moles forced land redistribution. Really interesting what's happening over there. You're going to want to read that right up at the new and revised trumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. For myself, Dwight Fault, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.